Well, hello again to everyone out there at TFMR. It is a holiday weekend, as you know. It's Martin Luther King Day on Monday here in the States. We got a three-day weekend. A lot of times on three-day weekends, we like to post kind of a special edition podcast. And man, do we have a special edition here. I've got a first-time guest, a guy I've been dying to get a chance to visit with and get to know. He's almost like a brother from another mother. Isn't that how they say that, Paul? I can't even get that out. This is Paul Milchrist. Many of you that have been around this site for a long time know who Paul is. His writings appear prominently here as guest posts. They're always put up at Zero Hedge whenever he puts them out. His actual title, he's an equity and cross asset strategist with ADM ISI in London. But he is much more than that and a very wise, learned guy. And I thought, wow, what a great chance to finally get a chance to visit with him. So, Paul, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
No, my pleasure, Craig. Really good to speak to you after all this time.
Like I said, you're kind of like a brother from another mother in that this, where I want to go with this is where you and I both at the same time, really, in the fall of 2014, without speaking to each other, without like, hey, Paul, have you seen this? I don't know, Craig, how about that? We both noticed the same correlation and began writing about it. And what I'm talking about is that correlation between the dollar-yen, that specific Forex pair, and digital gold, COMEX gold, electronic gold, the Forex, how that Forex pair affects the price of gold. And we write about it here at TFMR almost every day. You can see the correlation on a daily basis. But Paul, I wanted to start with that with you. How did you first notice this, and what do you think's behind it?
Yeah, sure. Going back to that period, at the time, I was taking a much kind of greater interest in shadow banking. And one thing I was really beginning to get to know was the repo market, and repo was obviously a big factor along with euro dollar illiquidity in terms of the 2007-2008 crisis. So, you know, if you're going to understand the financial markets these days, finally after all these years, I really started diving into some of the plumbing. And what I noticed was that from almost exactly the time that QE3 was announced in September 2012, the fall in the gold price was actually mirroring the decline in overnight repo rates. And given that the repo market is basically collateralized lending, you've got banks and you've got hedge funds involved. You've got a lot of the long short trades are financed in the repo market. So it just occurred to me that if the gold price was broadly tracking the decline in overnight repo. So, you know, as overnight repo was becoming cheaper, whoever it was had even greater kind of firepower to put on short gold trades. That perhaps on the other side of the short gold trade, there was an asset against that on the long side. And it was just a process of elimination. I didn't immediately think of the yen or the Nikkei. I tried, it was trial and error, really, S&P and various metals and things like that. And then I put the Nikkei on, and the correlation, was just almost perfect on an inverted basis. Mm-hmm. Versus gold. So that's what kind of led me to it. It was really a kind of, it was really by accident, in a way, as I was sort of delving into the repo market. But then the incredible thing is that, two incredible things. One was that, you'd come across it probably from a different aspect. But even more interestingly, the damn thing is still working today.
Yeah, exactly. Excuse me, Paul. Do you think is it a function of high frequency trading? Is it? I'll give you an example. It's almost as if high-frequency trading, computer trading, is leading to a correlation in almost everything. Someone posted on my site over the weekend that they had noticed an almost one-to-one correlation between Canadian stocks and the U.S. high-yield index. It's like, well, that doesn't make any sense at all, but they're trading one for one. It's almost as if, as HFT controls everything and as HFT takes all the same inputs, that now all of a sudden everything is going to be correlated. And in the end, you get just like one line on a chart for everything. I mean, I don't know that's obviously an extreme example, but is it HFT that are programmed specifically, do you think, for gold to follow the yen? Or is it, like you said, is it more this repo situation and a much larger macro scale that affects both?
I think it's probably both. But you know, let's try and sort of work out a couple of things and get a better idea on it. So you know, the fact that repo was involved, you know, made me think, you know, that you've got this sort of long short aspect to it, and a likelihood that major banks and hedge funds were putting on this trade, but you know, the fact that I mean, I'm looking at it now. So if I look at the yen versus gold between, for example, this, just looking on my screen, September 2011 and August 2012. So that was the year before QE3.
Right.
Okay. There is, you know, very little correlation. At times, they're going completely in the other direction. So, you know, the first point I'd like to make is, I think that with the implementation of QE3, there was a fear on behalf of the authorities that gold market would get out of control.
Precisely.
So, you know, they implemented a much greater kind of control over the gold market. And I think this was the way they did it, was put it onto a big, long short trade. That was one aspect of it. I think the second aspect is that there's some kind of, you know, HFT, computer-driven algo factor in there as well. And this goes back actually a few years, because I used to look at the charts on the Kitco website, and this really sort of goes back to some of the work that Gatter did and Bill Murphy, where he used to talk about the Plan A strategy of the cartel, which was to smash the gold price. Just as people woke up in London to kind of set the tone for the day.
Yeah.
And then we often used to see, a similar thing happen, you know, before the COMEX open, et cetera, et cetera. But then as I started to look at on Kitco, they had a particular, sort of chart where you could see, 3 days of trading, you know, across a 24-hour period on the same chart. And there was one fabulous example where 2 days running, the gold price basically almost perfectly tracked each other to the minute.
Yep.
One day after another.
Yep.
And, you know, that just shouldn't happen. And as I looked into this more closely, and this is a note I wrote, I think it was about 2011, 2012, but it was fascinating because what I found was five or six patterns that kept repeating themselves, and I sort of gave them different names, which I can't even remember now. But you know, that to me was just cast iron proof.
Mm-hmm.
That there were, you know, nefarious forces using computerized trading to try and control gold.
And so now here we are in 2017. You can clearly plot dollar yen versus gold for the last 12 months. And you can see, I mean, you can go back to last February where the dollar yen dropped 10% in 10 days. And that's when gold shot from 1160 to 1260 in 10 days. And anybody can do this. They can lay one on the other and see it. How do we break the shackles of this, Paul? I mean, I talk a lot about how eventually it's going to have to be physical demand that breaks the entire system. I mean, in the meantime, are we just subject to the whims of the yen in pricing gold until further notice?
I mean, that's my fear.
Yeah.
I think we've gone through a phase. I'm just sort of, as I'm talking to you, trying to bring up the right chart. Here it is. Okay. I wrote a piece on gold last year, and its sort of origin was some of the work that the guys at Bullion Star had done, where they'd looked into all of the central banks and made basically estimates where there wasn't any hard data. But they worked out how much gold was in the London vaults,
mm-hmm.
and we had the data from the Bank of England about they said how much gold was in London, and you could kind of match up the central bank gold held along with physical gold held by ETFs that were based in London as well. And what I noticed was that if you use that information, so you could come up with a gold float in London. You had ETFs, you had the central banks, and you had anything over and above that, and you could plot it through time, given the changes and the changes to the Bank of England data. And what I noticed was that, if we go back to, if you remember the horrific attack on gold on the gold price in April 2013.
Yep.
It was around about that time that the UK went from a net exporter or became a heavy net exporter of gold. And that lasted right through basically to the beginning of 2016, the early months of 2016. And I wrote this report, I think it was April, May last year. And my conclusion was that basically there was zero gold float in London if you excluded the central banks and the gold-backed ETFs. Now, what was interesting was pretty much as soon as I wrote that report, and I'm looking at the data here, the UK suddenly flipped from being a net exporter of physical non-monetary gold to being a net importer. So with hindsight, what I actually think happened is that the gold vaults in London, literally ran out of free float in terms of any physical gold. And we really did get close to the supply pinch that we've been, expecting and waiting for so long now. But we now have a situation where, at least as far as I can tell, there is a degree of comfort in the London gold vaults for the time being, as best I can tell. So sort of, as a rather long drawn out starting point, and I apologize, how the hell, do we get, the gold price to actually reflect, the supply and demand for physical? What I think it's going to take it to break, the correlation with the yen, we make the assumption that that the dollar is going to continue to be strong. We can come back to that, but this is kind of part of my thesis that the dollar will be strong. But what we need is some kind of shock, if you like, that would break the yen stroke gold relationship.
Yeah.
And what I think could do that is the shortage of dollar liquidity, which has become a structural issue in the financial markets. Don't know how you want to go about it, but if you want me to sort of delve into that, then very happy to do it.
I'm sorry, Paul. I didn't mean to interrupt you. That is definitely part number two of this call, and you teed it up. That was a perfect segue. I think you should take my job because you did it like a natural. You just went right from one to the other, and that's where we want to go next. Because We've written about this here at TFMR. I think it was just something within the last 2 weeks. We wrote about the growing dollar liquidity crisis in China. This is what happened last year. We've made, you know, regulars at this site know how many times we've noted, it's really since November. I mean, the price came down in November of 2016, just like it did in November 2015, all of it ahead of a Fed rate hike that occurred at that last FOMC. The price bottomed the very next day in both 2015 and 16, and now we're rallying kind of counter to what all of the supposed experts were saying was going to happen. And again, it all gets back to what happened after the rate hike in 2015. It set off, that strong dollar set off a pretty significant dollar liquidity, dollar shortage crisis in China and really all the emerging markets. And we're seeing that playing out again. It's even worse, it seems, this year than it was last year, Paul. Can you explain, this is a hard, I have a hard time getting my own arms around this. What does a dollar shortage mean? Why is there a dollar shortage? And what does it mean? And how does it fix itself? Because eventually last year, the dollar just rolled over and went back down and everything eased. Yeah. Is that what's going to happen again this year? Or do you see something different play out?
Yeah, well, my best guess, because that's all it's going to be, is that we do have another significant leg of dollar strength. But just you know, a little bit of background. So, you know, I think the way to think of it is that there are essentially two inventories of dollars. There's a domestic one in the U.S. and then there's an overseas one, which are basically known as euro dollars. All that means is dollars that are held as deposits outside the U.S. And there are flows between the two. But it's slightly different because for the inventory of dollars in the States, then you've got the Fed as a liquidity backstop, and now you obviously have all the excess reserves held by the banks at the Fed as well. Overseas, it's slightly different because let's just think about how a sort of a dollar liquidity problem has emerged. The first thing to say is that since the crisis in 2008, we've had a 70% increase in offshore euro dollar debt. So it's now in excess of 10 trillion, and most of that is in the emerging world. With regard let's give a kind of typical example. So let's imagine you have some kind of, you know, Hong Kong regional bank, and they lend dollars on a long-term basis to a Chinese steel company on the mainland. Going back to, 2011, 2012, 2013, et cetera, if you remember, the Chinese renminbi was seen as a one-way bet. It was only going to strengthen against the U.S. Dollar interest rates were lower than Chinese interest rates. So it made sense to borrow the money in dollars and not to hedge it. Why would you? But this, created these problems. So for the steel company and the bank end up with a currency mismatch. I mean, the bank may have hedged the currency, the steel company probably didn't. But the real problem for the bank, a regional Hong Kong bank, is that they have a maturity mismatch. So they will have lent dollars, say for 10 years to a steel company, but they will have to roll their dollar funding probably every 3 months or so. And in order to do that, they're going to have to keep borrowing dollars in the wholesale funding markets. The question then is, okay, well, who's likely to be lending these emerging world banks dollars? And it's basically, our friends at the big global euro dollar banks. So it's Citi, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Credit Suisse, et cetera, et cetera. They're basically, these dollars are just liabilities on New York-based banks. What you have is a situation where you've got a vast amount of dollar debt that needs rolling, where the dollar is strengthening, and critically, where the big global banks are becoming much, much less inclined to extend dollar balance sheet you know, particularly to the emerging world because of, you know, who necessarily wants to lend dollars ultimately to a dodgy concrete or steel company. Yeah. In China via some kind of regional Hong Kong intermediate or Taiwan or Singapore or wherever they may be. And, you know, so what you've got is this risk-averse nature increasingly of the major banks. And, you know, just really sort of making this even more serious is you've had the gradual implementation of the Basel III regulations since 2013. I think that's had a massive impact on constraining bank balance sheets. So, you know, ultimately you've got $10 trillion that needs of funding that needs rolling. And you've got, you know, less and less available dollar balance sheet. So that's where this dollar liquidity tightness has come from. And, you know, the great thing is, or I say great, you know, in terms of, you know, it's from a perspective of dislodging the control of the gold market, ultimately, is that dollar liquidity appears to be the one thing in recent years that the central banks can't control. So, you know, just run you through a few events where it's had a major impact. Now, I think the sort of embryonic event in terms of dollar liquidity was the surprise renminbi devaluation in February 2014. I think that's where it started. And then, you know, running through, the dollar started to rise in mid-2014. Then in January 2015, if you remember, the Swiss Central Bank broke its peg against the euro,
right,
citing dollar strength. So because the euro was going down, it was taking the Swiss franc with it in terms of the peg. And it's quite interesting, actually. If you go and look, instead of the Swiss franc versus the euro, look at the Swiss franc versus the dollar in January 2015. And as soon as the Swiss franc was freed from the euro, not surprisingly, it strengthened against every currency. But against the dollar, it immediately bounced back or weakened to almost where it started.
Right, I remember that.
And you think, why the hell was that? Well, the reason, I think, was because basically the Swiss banks, the major Swiss banks, had got themselves massively short of dollars. That was why the SNB had to break the peg. So as soon as that peg was broken, the Swiss banks went in, covered their short on the dollar, which is why the Swiss franc suddenly weakened versus the dollar to where it started. Then, you know, moving on, August 2015, we had the second Chinese renminbi devaluation.
Right.
And then in 2016, and this really is a weird one, but if you remember during 2016, basically, you know, we had the yen, where, you know, the Bank of Japan is monetizing at a rate of about 17% of GDP. So, you know, we all thought that the yen was, you know, doomed and was going to go through 125 and, you know, head to 200. And all of a sudden, it had this remarkable turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody says, oh, the yen, you know, what a great safe haven. And you're thinking, hang on, that doesn't really make sense. You know, I think the yen is rubbish. But, you know, it strengthened last year by 20% against the dollar. How on earth could it do that? And it literally took me months to work out how that happened. And actually, and this was the weird thing, because if you looked at what's called the yen cross-currency basis swap last year, just a sort of brief aside, these basis swaps between the dollar and other currencies give you an idea of the dollar liquidity problem in real time. So, for example, if any of your listeners have got Bloomberg, if you put JYBSC into Bloomberg, that will give you the three-month yen-dollar cross-currency basis swap. What it is, basically, is the cost of swapping yen into dollars on a three-month basis over and above the interest rate differentials. So in a benign environment where markets don't have necessarily any greater proclivity to transfer dollars into yen or vice versa, the basis swap will trade at zero. Now, it's not trading at zero. It's trading, well, currently minus 43 basis points. So what that's telling you is that the market will pay 43 basis points over the interest rate differential to transfer yen into dollars. And what was amazing was that as the yen strengthened 20% last year, the basis swap became more and more negative.
Yeah.
So that just didn't make sense. Why was there a greater desire to transfer yen into dollars, even though the yen was strengthening by 20%? And actually, it boils down to the mechanics of dollar liquidity. Because basically, if you think about it, with the US was raising rates, so three-month LIBOR was rising sharply. Yen LIBOR was in negative territory, and you had this basis swap, which was extremely negative. So, if you were actually a Chinese fund who'd put on the yen carry trade, so you might have particularly leveraged yen carry trade. If you'd basically borrowed yen into borrowed dollars, and then bought a 10-year treasury, for most of last year the 10-year treasury yields were collapsing. Dollar LIBOR was going through the roof, and the basis swap was collapsing. So essentially, the profitability on the yen carry trade was completely eliminated, having been 200 basis points, a year and a half ago.
Right.
So what happened was that the yen carry trade, to a great extent, was repatriated. It was purely a profit and loss thing. So even though the yen-dollar imbalance went even further in favor of the dollar, the yen was able to strengthen as some of that yen carry trade, which is obviously bigger than we all realize, was repatriated. And there was nothing the Bank of Japan could do about it, just as there was nothing the PBOC was able to do with the first two renminbi devaluations. There was nothing that the SMB could do when it devalued in January 2015. So you've got this situation where dollar liquidity, I think, is the one thing that central banks can't control.
So Paul, as you're being very generous, very generous with your time, and we've gone on longer than I borrowed from you. I told you we'd do this for 20 minutes, and we've gone on longer than that, and I really very much appreciate it because this is fascinating. But I want to be respectful of your time too. And so let me kind of nudge this back toward then the full circle.
China.
And what's going on in China, which is where we were a year ago, maybe even worse. Does this whole thing play out again? I mean, does instead of the yen surging through 125 and the dollar index going to 110 and all that kind of stuff, are we right back to where we were in January of last year, or maybe even worse, where instead everything plays out as you just described again, then the yen, the dollar yen goes down as the yen strengthens, and as we talked about that HFT correlation or whatever it is with gold, that makes gold go up and not down.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a couple of things here in terms of, the yen, it because you've got this big impact of the yen carry trade, it partly depends on what happens to U.S. Treasury yields. So when U.S. Treasury yields, if they rise, that's going to be good for the yen carry trade. But what I think what we really need though is for that yen gold relationship to break, and to break basically because we have some kind of financial dislocation which makes people shift into gold as really the last asset standing that hasn't been in a bubble. Now What I think is going to drive that is China, most likely in the coming months. So, you know, if you look at this dollar liquidity problem, we've already had two devaluations, but China to me is the focal point. They have, you know, using BIS data, my estimate is something in excess of $2 trillion of offshore dollar debt, and a more serious problem than most people realize. And they've already, you know, burnt through $1 trillion of FX reserves. And, you know, we can see how desperate they are to try and plug the capital outflows which are taking place, which is a bit like, you know, kind of QE in reverse. Now, I think one of the things is, you know, when people say, oh, well, they've been using their dollar reserves to defend their currency, and I think to an extent they've done that, but it's also more complex. So, you know, if you're a Chinese bank and you're really struggling to roll your dollar funding, which I think they are, you know, then in many cases you're probably going to go to the central bank. So the central bank is going to exchange the dollars that it has to Chinese banks in exchange for renminbi. Now, what that does is that pulls renminbi out of the Chinese money markets and the banking system. Yeah. So you have this dual impact where you have a dollar liquidity problem, which also leads to a domestic renminbi liquidity problem. And that's what we're seeing at the moment, in my view. So, you know, I don't know, people don't seem to understand the extent of this. So just to give you some data. So I'm looking at a Bloomberg chart here. So since the beginning of the fourth quarter 2014, the PBOC's claims on commercial banks in China. Now, that basically means the amount of renminbi that the central bank has basically has had to give to its own banking system is in excess of $6 trillion, which is, you know, there or thereabouts $1 trillion. You know, that is just off the scale.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you would think, wouldn't you, that if you've got a renminbi liquidity problem as well, you're going to see interbank rates in China go through the roof. And that's what you were seeing. So if you put up, for example, overnight SHIBOR, you'll see that spiked at the back end of last year right through to the early part of this year.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, it's kind of slipped back again. And, you know, what I think is that, the PBOC has had to put, you know, even more. We've only got the November data, but I think, you know, they've probably thrown the kitchen sink in terms of pushing liquidity into the banking system over the last 2 months. But my point is, you know, I don't think overnight SHIBOR is what you should be looking at. What you should look at, I think, is the 3 month tenor of SHIBOR, and that is spiking, and that is telling you there's still a liquidity problem. It's getting much worse. So one thing I use to try and look at the stress of the Chinese banking system is the spread between 3 month and overnight SHIBOR, and that's going parabolic at the moment. So I think the PBOC is under, you know, really, really serious distress at the moment. And I think an example of that was, you know, when they literally slammed the offshore renminbi at the back of, slammed the CNH, so, you know, bought offshore renminbi against dollars at the end of last week. And we had the biggest 2-day rise that we've ever seen.
Right.
And I think that was desperation as we approached 7. But, you know, I tend to think that they're losing, you know, they're fighting a losing battle on this dollar liquidity issue, because it's not going to go away. It's structural. So my suspicion is, you know, we will see that in the coming months, China faces a currency crisis. And, you know, it could be that which, you know, really rattles markets, really rattles the Chinese population, because, you know, you've got one of the highest M2 to GDP ratios anywhere in the world. They have a whole load of savings, and they're not going to want them in RMB. I mean, we already know that, you know, from what Bitcoin's done. So, you know, if I'm right, and if we're heading, you know, or meandering towards a Chinese currency crisis, that could be, you know, and the repercussions of that could be what breaks the yen-gold relationship, and what leads to, you know, finally a major, or, you know, a significant move into physical gold, you know, rather than, you know, long in the tooth gold bugs, but a much more general appreciation. But, you know, we've been waiting for this for a long time, but, you know, my sort of sneaking feeling is a Chinese currency crisis could do it, but, you know, we will see.
In the end, Paul, it seems positive either way for this, for the gold price, in that either the central banks, as you said, that can't really control this issue very well, either they respond as they did last year, specifically the Fed, you know, and you buy treasuries and you force long rates lower rather than the higher, as everybody expects, and you get the dollar to go down rather than up, and that somehow puts a Band-Aid over this issue and eases the pressure on the PBOC. Or, on the other hand, the market doesn't allow them to do this, and this all spirals out of control, and you have this full-fledged crisis in China. Either way, that would seem to augur, you know, $800 gold is not in the offing, as so many have tried to convince out there.
Yeah, I really hope not. I mean, I don't see it. You know, I've learned over the years, never say never, but I'm beginning to feel a bit more optimistic for a change.
Yeah. Well, my friend, I tell you what, this has been fascinating. And like I said, I want to be respectful of your time, so I think we'll stop here for now. But why don't we visit again sometime soon, Paul? Because
I'd love that. That'd be great.
I think, again, this is such a fascinating perspective. And it's just, you're able to explain it in a way that everybody can understand. But this is, so much of this is above my pay grade level. It's hard. It's educational for me to hear. So I can only imagine how fascinating this has been for everybody listening. It's great stuff, Paul. And I really hope we can speak again soon, because I think this is going to be a wildly unpredictable year.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, we may need to discuss it again in a couple of months. So let's see how we go.
In the meantime, my friend, thank you so much for your time. And I hope you have a great rest of your day.
No, have a good long weekend.
Thank you. And thanks to everybody for listening, and have a great weekend.